Hi, everybody. Bob Claster here, and I'm the host for Funny Stuff, half an hour of comedy, which airs every Tuesday night here on KCRW at 7 o'clock. And I hope you had a chance to hear last week's program, because it was the first half of a conversation which I had with John Cleese in his hotel room. And tonight is, of course, the second half. And John Cleese, for those of you who don't know, and first of all, if you don't know, you should be ashamed of yourself. John Cleese was one of the members of Monty Python's Flying Circus, a truly groundbreaking, landmark, and above all, very funny British comedy group that made a wonderful television series and a number of terrific films. And he was the star and one of the co-writers of Fawlty Towers, a terrific British situation television comedy. And he is also the star of a very funny film entitled Clockwise, which is now appearing around town and which was the reason for Cleese's visit to Los Angeles. Anyhow, we'll talk about Clockwise, we'll talk about the Life of Brian, we'll talk about Monty Python, we'll talk about a lot of things. And it started out like this. Do you miss doing sketch comedy where you can come up with an idea which wouldn't necessarily support an entire film or an entire show that's, you know, maybe a five-minute idea?
Yes, it's very good. I do miss that just occasionally, because sometimes I suddenly think of something either that I want to say or a point that I want to make, or something that just strikes me as being terribly funny out of the blue, like a parody of Rambo. Mm-hmm. And I don't really have the means to do it at the moment. But it's okay, because I often scribble the ideas on a little bit of paper and stick them in the drawer. And it would be perfectly possible for me, when I get clearer present commitments, to suddenly decide that I had a nice little collection of funny ideas. And if I rang up a television station in England and said I'd like to do an hour's show, on the whole, it wouldn't be too difficult to get them to allow me to do it, you know.
And that's a wonderful position to be in. There probably aren't many people that could do that.
I mean, provided they didn't have to pay me or anything. Well, provided they paid me by BBC standards, which is sort of, you know, like working for charity, really.
But then you distribute it in America and the video cassette rights. And
now I'm interested. Yeah. Again, yeah.
And we'll talk.
That we'll talk.
Something that most Americans don't know is that concurrently with the Python TV series, you were in a BBC radio series called I'm Sorry, I'll Read That Again.
And that's all I wish to say about that.
It is.
Yeah, I thought it has been wildly overpraised by a lot of people. It was a cheery, noisy, slightly vulgar show that relied on bad puns and an incredibly active interventionist audience who groaned and moaned and laughed like hyenas at things that were slightly funny. And the audience was the funniest thing in the show, actually, because the degree of their support, it was like playing in front of a football crowd. And it was kind of fun and of no interest artistically whatsoever.
Well, I've heard the two records that were made from it.
Well, they're not very good, are they?
There are moments.
Exactly.
There are some moments. Exactly. I like the Taming of the Shrew sketch.
There are moments in Joan Rivers' shows.
The Taming of the Shrew sketch is nice.
I've forgotten it, you see, because I did 106 of them.
And the John and Mary routine is
pretty
good.
One or two of those routines are quite good.
And
but
the babies?
I did 106 of them. I once realized that if you started playing them back to back, they would go on solidly for over 2 days. And when I thought of the Sundays that I'd wasted doing that, when I could have been lying in bed eating food and...
Well, the question is basically, do you like doing radio?
Yes,
and
I love doing
radio. Do you think you might do something for radio again?
Oh, that's interesting. Yes, I think I might. I might, actually. I mean, the great thing about radio is that it creates a slightly conspiratorial, at least intimate, relationship with people listening. You feel much more in contact. I think people listening now will feel more in contact with me, more as though they know me, as if in some way they're eavesdropping on a more private conversation and are therefore more involved in it than they would if we were having exactly the same chat on television. Also, in television, there's all this technology getting in the way, you know. Whereas we can sit here now, and I'm much less distracted by the technology, by these two little microphones by us, you know, that we're just talking in a sense, and we're aware that the microphones are there, but it's much more like a real conversation. It's a smashing medium. If I was ever going to do a talk show, I nearly said chat show, talk show, I think I would certainly want to do it on radio. The other thing about radio is you don't have to justify it with huge listening figures. You can actually do something that's, for me, a little bit more intelligent. You don't have to immediately think, oh, we've got to have a joke every 30 seconds or a car chase or police cars smashing into each other to keep people switched on.
Are there any tapes still extant of the At Last the 1948 show? I saw one of them at the Museum of Broadcasting in New York and thought it was just super.
It was a very good, very interesting show. Marty Feldman, Graham Chapman, myself, Tim Brooke Taylor, recorded end of 66 and beginning of 67. We did a dozen for the Frost organization, who very kindly wiped them. Pretty astounding. Mind you, the broadcast quality is pretty crummy by today's
standards. Because one tape does exist.
Well, I have one. What was the one you saw? Do you remember?
It was years ago that I saw
it. Any sketches in it at all?
The one that I remember apparently ran through all of them with the blonde who was trying to become famous.
Oh, she was terrific, yes. She used to come out, she was the archetypal showgirl, and we just kind of did her as a send-up because it was supposed to be a show business show, and none of us were very show business. And she used to come out. I remember she did a wonderful joke, which I love one. She came out, and she used to talk in this silly voice, because actually, if she got a little bit pissed, she used to... you don't say pissed, do you? What do you mean?
Drunk.
Yeah. If Amy got a little bit
pissed drunk... Pissed means angry here.
That's right. It's pissed off in English. It's so complicated. if Amy got a little bit drunk, she would come and start... You know, really talking in quite a broad Scottish accent like this. But the moment she was sober again in the morning, she talked like this. Oh, she used to say, isn't that nice? Most extraordinary voice. It's just a little bit like Anna Elk in the Python sketch. And I remember she came out, she used to come out and say things to the audience like, are you interested in astrology? I am, she'd say. My star sign is Leo. That's like Burt Lancaster. I wonder what it says in the newspapers today. She'd open up the newspaper and she said, here's the astrology, Leo. Your name is Amy MacDonald and you are reading out your horoscope live on television. Oh, she'd say, that's good, isn't it? And a long pause and she'd say, not very good for Burt Lancaster, though. I thought it was a wonderful show. And we used to write this rubbish for her to link the sketches. But I was in Copenhagen about 6 weeks ago, and I was just walking on the pavement, and a young fellow came running up, saying hi, and I was in a hurry, but I kept walking, and he walked with me. And suddenly I stopped in my tracks, because he said to me, I have some old 1948 show tapes. And I said, this is not possible. And he said, yes, I recorded them 10 years ago when they were transmitted in Sweden.
Mm.
So I've sent him a check, and I'm hoping to receive them. It'd be wonderful to have them again, because there were a few sketches I did there with Marty, that particularly because Marty's no longer with us, that I would treasure to get my hands on, particularly what we used to do, a particular type of sketch, Marty and I, in which I would be boring upper-class man in bookshop or whatever, and he would be annoying little rat-like pest, and he would come in and simply annoy me, pester me, and drive me mad. And I used to love doing those sketches with him, but there was a particular one in a railway carriage that I would pay a lot of money.
Do you remember a lot of your routines? I mean, you were able
very
to remember
them. So, that one I was, because that stuck with me. It stuck in my mind over the years, as I thought particularly funny. But no, I can remember them in a sort of shadowy way.
You couldn't rattle off Startistics, for instance.
Well, I used to do that in cabaret. So if I had a couple of hours to refresh the memory traces, I probably could. I usually find if I sit and think about something, it will eventually start to come back. The things that I can remember at the drop of the hat are always the nonsense.
The things that you had to try so hard to remember.
Absolutely. Because though it took you 3 or 4 weeks to learn it, I can still say Johann Gumbel putted the von Alsfernschbladen Schlitt Quest Quen Bonfire Dingo Dango Dongo Burstein von Nacker Thrasher Appleback and Ticker Lindsay Grander not his spell Tinker Grumble Mar Wasser Kirstlich Kippel Eisenbahn Wagen Guten Abend Bitte Ein Nürnberger Braster for Ein Nürnberger Braster. Anyway, you know, I haven't said that for 2 years.
Yeah.
It comes back nice. And say the carts and temperatories met the coupes and never caught the Murgatuses, lest of Venus cruise upon a part of Isaac cruise together, he moods low in the underpelletin. All that complete nonsense, which is a sketch I wrote when I was 20. It was one of the sketches I got into the Footlights in 1960, and I learned it off, and I can still... we had a great game here at Gradual this afternoon with Manchester over Thrasher Field Thursday with 2-1 in the kind of game at Hellstar will soon be beaming to California. Thursday started fast and tough. An under 23 international arm pitch went close with a grand 20-yard left 40-yard for spotted London Palladium Black. I mean,
those are amazing things. The things you carry around with you every day.
Yes, and those are tapes that I can play because
They're
incredibly difficult to learn. But if you learn dialogue that makes perfect sense, Mm-hmm. You forget it 4 days later, because somehow there's no effort involved in memorizing. It's commonsensical, so you wipe the tape very quick.
Okay, chronologically moving forward, at last, at what point...
Yeah, I forgot we were doing that.
At what point, if any, in the history of Monty Python, did you realize that you were really onto something legendary, something that would be, say, to television what the Goon Show was to radio?
Oh, a long time after it started. I mean, the great moment for me was about 4 minutes into the first show when the audience started to laugh, because I can still remember saying to dear Michael Palin in the dressing rooms just 10 minutes before the first recording ever took place, I remember saying to him so clearly, as you see him standing there as a photograph in my mind, saying to him, you realize we may be just about to do an entire 30-minute comedy television show, total silence. And he said, yes. He just had the same realization. And then Terry Jones and Graham Chapman went out and did the bit about the flying sheep, and the giggles started about 3 minutes in, and that was a great moment. I don't know who that is, but maybe they want to be in the interview.
It's probably Jehovah's Witnesses coming to tell us something.
Apparently the thing to say to them is, oh good, I'm Jehovah, how much have we collected?
Speaking of religion, yeah. How do you explain the fact that Life of Brian, which is actually fairly unobjectionable, mm-hmm. got so much abuse from the religious community, and yet The Meaning of Life, which contains a vicious attack on the Catholic Church's attitude toward birth control, went completely...
Well, it's also got a wonderful attack on what passes for religion in the Church of England. I mean, that particular chapel service, do you remember when they start off with a prayer that says, "Ooh, God, you are so huge. Yes. Gosh, we're all so impressed down here on earth because you are, well, frankly, God, you are fantastic. You know, we just think you're terrific. Don't hurt us because we're very pathetic and you're so big it wouldn't be fair." You know, and if you wanted to smash the devil's faces, you really could, which is a wonderful parody of the kind of nonsense that was given to me at school in the name of religion. The sort of great headmaster in the sky, and if you obey the school rules, you go to heaven, and if not, you fry in hell. And that lovely hymn at the end that starts, "Oh Lord, please don't burn us," finishes up with the last line, "Don't stir fry us in a wok." I agree. I don't know why, but I've noticed in the past that when people get offended, it is usually completely arbitrary. And if the film is then played again 2 years later, everybody has stopped bothering to protest. Well, the reason that people get offended is that it lights something in themselves. You know, there is nothing to do with the fact that they really think it's offensive. What people didn't like about The Life of Brian was the central message, which is that there are a lot of people behaving extremely badly in the name of religion. We were never making fun of Christ. We were making fun of the way that a lot of people have followed Christ and other religious leaders. And that's what they didn't like. They couldn't bear the fact we were making fun of them, the followers.
You think they actually saw the movie and got the point of it?
No,
then?
At an unconscious level they got it. And that's what made them...
That'll give them
furious.
That credit.
No, I think unconsciously people get a lot more than they can consciously, because the unconscious way of getting things is not too much to do with IQ intelligence. And I think that they got a feeling that they were being got at. And the people who protested were exactly the ones we were trying to get at. And the people that I know who genuinely are, in my view, religious, including a remarkable man who did a series of 13 programs the BBC called The Long Search about various world religions, a man called Ron Eyre, said to me that he actually thought it was a profoundly religious film, and I may actually make a film, a comedy film, with Ron. The only other project I am really interested in one day that is about religion. But people who use religion to build their egos up, to make themselves feel more important and more righteous, have totally missed the point of religion. Which is why Christ always went on about the self-righteous, and why he attacked the Pharisees, who were so good at... That's legalistic religion. That's I am in the right, they are wrong, because the rules say so. That kind of attitude. Christ always attacked that, you see. So these Pharisees, in quote, came out and protested against us because at a deep level they knew that we were taking the piss out of them. And at a deep level I know they deserved it.
Because
there's
wonderful justice to the fact that they helped your business. They got more people to see them.
They helped us on the coast, but they helped to kill us in the Midwest and the South. And I think it was a trade-off. I mean, it got us on the evening news. That's why they're not too bright, you know. They're actually protesting like that to do God a favor and to give themselves a warm glow of having done a good job for the day, and gosh, aren't we superior to those people over there. And the moment that people use their religion to feel superior to other people, again, that's the moment they've lost the point of it. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I can say that and attack these people because I see these tendencies in myself. I see a tendency in myself. And I catch myself at it trying to use my religious ideas as a way of feeling superior to other people. You know? So that's in all of us.
We can assume that the book is closed on Monty Python?
Well, I don't know, because I did say to the others some time ago, wouldn't it be fun to make another film? And they all looked at me balefully, and I added, when we're 50. And they brightened up a bit, because they thought it was a decrepit old bunch of drink-sodden, pot-bellied, balding Englishmen getting together as the rebellious young anarchistic group, you know. And I then suggested that maybe we should make a film that viciously attacked young people, you know, and health.
It's a pro-war movie.
No, a separate project, but just attack them for being young and vigorous and healthy. Really put the boot in on them, so everybody over the age of about 38 really loved the film, and all the young people would feel picked upon and resentful. And I think that's a wonderful idea.
Wait about 4 years then.
Well, five and a half we'd have to wait, because Michael Palin's the youngest, he's 44 and a half. I'd quite like to work with them again, though, as Terry Gilliam apparently said to somebody, he said, we're much more a dining club now than a work unit.
But you are still in touch, and
oh yeah, I'm going on holiday with Michael Palin in about 4 weeks' time. I'm actually writing him a part of the film that I'm writing at the moment, and I had dinner with Graham Chapman 3 or 4 months ago. Let me think. And I'm going to see Eric Idle, who's just opened in a fantastically successful version of The Mikado. Which Jonathan Miller has directed, and so I'm going to see Eric in about 3 weeks. I haven't seen Terry Jones for a bit because he's been directing a film. Do you know anything about that?
No. I was going to ask you what they're all doing, so that.
Well, I can rather. Well, Michael Palin had a slightly unsatisfactory few months trying to get things written, and then Terry Jones changed his mind a couple of times, and Michael's now writing a movie. Terry went off to direct a film about a marvelous sort of conventional middle-class woman called Cynthia Payne, who ran a famous brothel in South London where she used to accept luncheon vouchers, and she used to do an all-in deal, as far as I remember. Sort of guys of about 60 would come along, civil servants, and the whole thing was they got to go upstairs with a young lady. When they came down, they got a cup of tea and a poached egg on toast. And they could give her the luncheon vouchers that the firm gave. It's lovely. And he's directed this. I can't remember the name of it. And apparently it is looking extremely good. And Graham Chapman is trying to set up a film that he and I wrote a script of rather a long time ago. We originally wrote it for Carlo Ponti, to be done by Sellers and Sophia Lawrence, so that's how long ago it was. It's a good script, and he's been trying to set that up for some time. And I don't know how negotiations are advanced. And Terry Gilliam is about to do Baron Munchausen, because he loved, the great thing about Terry Gilliam, apart from having a wonderful visual sense, is that he loves really big budgets. You know, and what he really wants is a budget for a film of about $384 million. Then he'll be happy.
Does Terry Gilliam know that your new film is being distributed by Universal?
No, I thought I would break it to him slowly.
Speaking of the new film, it's a first in many ways. It's the first film in which you are the sole star.
This is true.
And the first film for playwright Michael Frayn and director Christopher Morahan, who directed Jewel in the Crown.
That's right.
How did such an illustrious group come together?
Well, I think there have always been four writers in the London Theatre that I felt real awe for at times, because what they were writing seemed to be out of reach so far as anything I could ever do is concerned. Peter Nichols, and I finally worked with him on Privates and Parade about 3 years ago, when I played quite a big part, but it wasn't really as big or as juicy a part as that wonderful part played by Dennis Quilly. So you're quite right that clockwise is a sort of my first main role, where I'm much bigger than anyone else. So having worked with Peter Nichols, I was then keen to, in a funny kind of way, to work with Michael Frayn, because along with Tom Stoppard, Malon Akeborn, he's the other, those are the four guys, I think, you're absolutely tops. I had no idea that this script was in the pipeline, but one day on my doormat there was a script, and I opened it up, and it said by Michael Frayn, and I sat down, read it, called my agent, said I wanted to do it, and that was it. Mm-hmm. And from then on, the guy who was acting as producer, as a theatrical producer, who's produced a great number of Michael Frayn's plays in London, called Michael Codron, a very interesting guy. It is very, very high quality theatre. He'd been trying to get me in plays for years, but I don't, you know what a lazy son so I am, and I don't like acting that much. And I finally said to him, having made excuses, I said, Mike, I have better things to do in the evening than get up on stage every night, you know, including going to watch other actors getting up on stage every night. So he finally stopped asking me for stage plays, but he sent me the script, which was great, because although it's perfect casting for me, Michael Frayn had not thought of me. And then we sat down and we thought, well, what, you know, what could, what can we think of to somebody who's going to be right to direct it? And we had a few ideas, and the one that really stuck was Christopher Morahan, because he had just directed an adaptation that Michael Frayn had done of a Chekhov play called Platonov, which is just opening in Los Angeles as we record this now. It's called Wild Honey. It was in the National Theatre. What is this? 21 months ago. And I went, it's one of the finest things I've ever seen in the theatre, so I came out of it and called Michael Codron the next morning and said, let's do it with Morahan. And Morahan is vastly experienced, because not only Jewel in the Crown, he was Peter Hall's number two at the National Theatre for 4 years. Mm-hmm. He was head of plays at the BBC for 7 or 8 years. He's a very, very experienced and wise old bird.
Tell us a little bit about the movie.
The movie's about a headmaster.
You get to go to autopilot now.
Yes, okay, I just we'll get the right tapes. Well, we started together in 1969. No, that's the part Monty Python tape. Oh, yes, Tony Jason came to me and he said, you know the way we can make a lot of money is to make industrial... No, wait a minute, that's the wrong tape, I'll get it. Clockwise, which one's that? Oh, yes. It's about a headmaster, and he's a very dynamic and go-ahead headmaster with a lot of energy, and the boys like him. He has a good sense of humor. Is that the right type? Yes. And he is running a big state school in the middle of England, and he is an ambitious guy. I think he maybe has political ambitions. He certainly wants to go right to the top in education, and this is the biggest day of his life because he has just been elected chairman of the group of headmasters of all the poshest schools in England, called the Headmasters Conference, it's called. And he has, as a result of being elected chairman, that day to travel 150 miles across England to a town called Norwich where the conference is being held, and he has to get up in front of all these very posh headmasters and deliver the keynote speech as chairman. And the day starts with him at the school that he runs, and the morning assembly, and telling the boys about the fact he's going across the country to Norwich, and then how he goes to the station, misses the train, and the rest of the film is about how he tries to get to Norwich with things going wrong and his life and career crumbling, and whether or not he gets to Norwich at the end, and the fact that he does, but not quite in circumstances that you would expect.
Well, it's nice to see you doing some comedy again.
Yes, I suppose it is. I mean, it was a pleasure to do. I really did it because I've always wondered, if you have an absolutely first-class script, a really experienced on-the-ball director who holds the reins and keeps everything well organized and under control and gives you top-class direction, a terrific crew, best crew I've ever worked with the possible exception of Silverado, lovely people, and a cast of people as good as and as nice to work with as people like Stephen Moore, who you don't know here in America, is genius.
We actually know him from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which has been outrageously successful for us on the station. We've played the radio series over and over and over again.
Great. Well, he's wonderful. He's one of the funniest men I've ever seen as a performer. And Alison Steadman. Penelope Wilton, who's a great actress, all these people. I thought, given all these good things, can I still enjoy acting? And after 8 weeks on the movie, I was able happily to say no. It's bloody boring. It's extraordinarily hard work. It's amazingly repetitious. Incredible amounts of energy and time are wasted. You have to get up every morning, shave, you've got to look good the whole time. You can't play football at half time.
And then rearrange the mud splatters on your face so that they match them
exactly.
From the last take.
It's a whole thing. It's a total waste of time, except, of course, you're disgracefully well paid. So it was a very interesting experience. I'm very pleased with the film. I think it's genuinely funny. It took fantastic business in England. It took Rambo money in England.
Mm.
But I think that was something to do with the fact that the English are very pleased to see a genuinely funny English film.
And well, it might have something to do with the fact that you're in it as well.
Yes, yes, but not a great deal, because, I mean, nobody came to see Privates on Parade. They stayed away in their millions on that film.
But that's such a sweet movie. I...
Yeah, it is a sweet movie, but all this thing about stars getting people in. No, if the whole thing works, people come. And, this is a perfect example. I mean, Privates on Parade took, probably 1/30th. Mm-hmm. Of the money that this movie played. I was a lead in both. Now, it's something to do with the fact that the right thing with the right people and the right director and above all the right script, that's what makes it happen.
Well, just as they might not be in a hurry to see Sylvester Stallone playing Shakespeare, I think that might be pretty funny.
Hamlet. If he did Hamlet, I would cross the Atlantic.
I'd like to see him do Ophelia, I mean. But, the fact that this time you're doing
Polonius
broad physical comedy.
Polonius, he'd be funny.
I'd just like to hear him try to read some of those lines. At any rate, the fact that you're now doing much closer to what you were known for.
Yes, yes. That's right. Well, it was one of my authority figures falling apart under stress.
What's next? What are you working on since you finished making that?
Writing a script, because I want to work with one guy called Charlie Crichton, who is immensely aged and very wise. He was editing film for Alexander Korda in England before Hitler came to power. He does know what he's doing. In fact, he's expert. And we're knocking together a script, and I want to have Kevin Kline in it, because I adore Kevin, not just personally, but I think he's a genius, because he's only straight actor I know. He's also a great clown. I mean, only great straight actor I know is also a great clown. Michael Palin, who is a joy to be around, is very funny. And Jamie Lee Curtis, who is a sweet girl and wonderful at being totally lovable while being completely wicked, which is what the character requires. And we'll get one or two other people in who I've not definitely approached yet, those good English character actors. And a lot of it will be about the Anglo-American love-hate relationship.
Which you, having married two of them, are an expert
I'm
on.
I'm an expert on that particular aspect, yes.
why do you keep marrying American women?
I think they're interesting. Yeah. Difficult, but interesting. I suppose I'd rather be interested.
Well, I married one, so I...
I think that they are interesting, and they've got a kind of energy. Also, I'm astonishingly impressed by... It may seem a very bizarre thing to say, by American women who are about 50 always have such energy.
Well,
you happy?
I'm very happy. Say goodnight, Gracie.
Goodnight, Gracie.
And that's going to wrap up this edition of Funny Stuff featuring our conversation with John Cleese. Special thanks, of course, to John Cleese for putting up with it, and also special thanks to Sally Bartel, who made it possible. And once again, a reminder that Cleese's new film, Clockwise, is playing, I believe, at the Fairfax, the Plitt Century City, and someplace in Orange County, I think the Edwards Costa Mesa. I may be wrong about these things. The management is not held responsible, etc., etc. But it's well worth your $6. It's worth remembering that every time you buy a movie ticket for $6, you are casting a vote on the future history of motion pictures. Sort of the last real vestige of participatory democracy left to us, at least in the world of entertainment. At any rate, let's see. Next week's program is going to be having to do with Halloween, of ghosts and goblins and so on and so forth, assuming I can scrounge up half an hour's worth of material on that subject. And if not, God only knows what I'll play. So until then, this is your host, Bob Claster, thanking you for listening and reminding you to always keep that sense of humor well exercised, because you never know when you're going to need it. Have a good week, everybody. I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.